job. I have the privilege of introducing Bob to speak for us tonight. He's my dad. Isn't that fun? So he came all the way from Leona Valley, California, and I'm sure he'll share a little bit about that. But it's also his belly button birthday today. So happy birthday. And what an honor and a privilege to introduce my father as the speaker at this meeting. So thank you, Dad, for staying sober, and thank you for coming and speaking with us.
Okay. Good evening. I'm Bob Koch, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Sandra, for the wonderful introduction, and thank you, Bill, for asking me to share. Bill did a super job as far as informing me, about the meeting and the formats and everything, and then called and reminded me on Monday, which is when I take a commitment. That's what I try to do, is set it up well in advance and then call and remind the person that, oh, guess what? You're speaking on Wednesday. The important stats, if anyone's curious, yes, I am sober. I got sober January the 24th of 1989. And have not... The belly button birthday, I turned 64 today. So that was the belly button birthday, turned 64. And if you do a little bit of math in that, I was actually, around 35 years old when I got sober. It's been a few years since I quit drinking. And January the 24th, we share and talk about in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like today, how the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have changed my life and what they do for me today and in my daily life. After those years of sober, there's a couple things. I have some good news and bad news. The good news is Alcoholics Anonymous will keep you sober and will give you a life beyond your wildest dreams. The bad news is you gotta quit drinking. You can't have a spiritual awakening while you're throwing up in the toilet. It doesn't work. We've tried that and it doesn't work. My first time in a blackout, and we share a little bit about what it used to be like so that people can relate and so forth. I love alcohol. I love the effects of alcohol. I love what it did to me. And it says in the big book, in the doctor's opinion about me, that the reason I drink primarily is for the effect. And I drank alcohol primarily for the effect. And the first time I went to jail in the blackout was, I was 15 years old, and my buddy David, his brother had ID. We all went together, Lucas, David, and David's brother, down to a little town called Elsinore, California, because they had a motorcycle track down there where they had TT races. We're going to watch the races, and we stopped at a liquor store on the way down there to get a little stuff to have alongside the track and enjoy ourselves. And I had money. I had a job. I worked at a rental yard and was repairing equipment and so forth. And I purchased a six-pack of Colt 45. And a bottle of whiskey. I think it was probably a half pint. And I drank down the bottle of whiskey and started on the Colt 45, and the rest of the evening is hearsay. Before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober and learned the proper language and so forth, I never had blackouts. Alcoholics had blackouts. I had memory lapses. I just had a memory lapse. And that, people can forget things, and I forgot the entire evening. But I was told later on what happened was, is I was drinking and having a good time, and I tripped over this guy's ice chest and spilled all of his beer. Well, the unfortunate part was, is he was an off-duty Elsinore police officer. And myself and David and Luke, we all went to jail for drunk in public. And David's brother split because he didn't want to get busted for contributing. So We went to jail. My dad came down, bailed us out. And a significant part really is that the next morning, I was a little bit late for work. My dad gave me a ride over to the rental yard. And this guy, Roy, who owned the rental yard where I worked at, was a... He started the morning off at 9 o'clock in the morning. There was a liquor store next door to the rental yard. And he'd go over there and buy a bottle of blackberry brandy. And that's what he started the morning with at 9 in the morning. He came over and he with his bottle of blackberry brandy. And he took a pull off the bottle and he looked at me and he said, "Bob, if you keep drinking like that, someday you'll drink for the same reason that I do." He took another drink off the bottle and he says, "You'll drink because you have to drink." And that was the best that one alcoholic sharing to another could try and do. He knew that he was trapped. You know, and Roy was this. I was 15 years old, and he was this really old guy. He was like 45. You know, like older than dirt. And he was a very successful businessman. He owned a rental yard. He owned a car wash. He had a house on the country club. All the stuff that, you know, it's like if I only had this stuff, I could get it together and everything be fine. And he made it to about 52 before he died of cirrhosis of the liver. You know, and was a wealthy man. But our social standing, where we are, what we do, he was had worked as a machinist for many years and was a very intelligent, very successful career person and died from the disease of alcoholism. I said, "Man, that's not me. I'm not going to drink because of that. That's not going to be anything like me. It's not going to happen to me." And I did the best that I could to do what it says that I can't do in our big book, and that's I cannot control and enjoy my drinking. You see, because if I try to control my drinking is I can't enjoy it. And if I enjoy my drinking, then the drinking is totally out of control. That's the two things I can't put together is control and enjoy my drinking. But I tried very, very hard to control my drinking for many years after that. And that's what I did. I was somewhat successful for a few years. I went to school and I studied electronics and I went in the same field that my dad had worked on. And I can't blame my alcoholism on my dad. He was a great dad. He did a good job. He was not an alcoholic and he set an excellent example for me. But I can only blame my drinking on the fact that I'm an alcoholic, that I have that allergy that it talks about in our big book. The allergy of the obsession of the mind and the physical allergy of the body. When I drink, I can't stop. When I put that substance into my body, it's like one's too many and a thousand isn't enough. That's the problem. Years ago in a little educational thing that I got to go through, invited by the courts, they were talking about controlling and enjoying your drinking and so forth. And the way that the guy put it, and it really upset me and screwed up my drinking, was that if you think you can control and enjoy your drinking before you leave home to go to the bar, decide, "I'm going to have one beer tonight. I'm only going to have one drink." And see, I can't do that, because when I have a drink, then just one more isn't going to hurt. And one more isn't going to hurt. And sometimes after a period of time, I might make it home. And other times, I come out of a blackout not knowing what happened in the evening. You know, that's my problem. That's why I'm an alcoholic, because when I put alcohol into my system, I have no idea what's going to happen and where it's going to take me and where I'm going to end up. And I tried really, really hard to raise a family. Like I said, I went to school and I went into a field that was a very good field for me. And it's very same field that my dad worked in. And that was working for police and fire department communications, working on their radios and their electronics and all that. And by the time I was 20 years old, I was building undercover cop cars to bust those nasty old guys that smoked pot and took drugs, and then getting drunk with the cops after work. And I got news, if you're drinking with the cops, they don't card you. And the cops that I drank with would handcuff you to the bar if you wanted to leave, because only alcoholics drink alone, right? So, no, we're not done drinking yet. You can't go home. Had a really good career doing that, and I went through school and went into that field, and it was an excellent field. But periodically, I would do what they say, overshoot the mark. And by overshoot the mark, I'm probably, what happened to me is different times I would start drinking, and I don't know what happened. One time, I was working for the railroad in Winslow, Arizona, for the Topeka and Santa Fe Railroad in Winslow, Arizona, and I decided after work to go have a couple of beers, and then I was going to drive to the Grand Canyon. And I came out of a blackout when I was being arrested by the Winslow Police Department. And so what I did is I hired a lawyer, I paid him a whole bunch of money, and I got that reduced down to an infraction of pulling away from the curb in an unsafe manner. Now that's the... back in the 1970s, you could get out of stuff by basically paying a lot of money to a lawyer, and it was a $500 fine back in 1970s when that was basically a month's wages for an average person, a $500 fine for pulling away from the curb in an unsafe manner. But they were quite ready to dismiss the DUI for getting the money and figure, well, maybe you won't do it again. 1979, I went to work for the County of Los Angeles, maintaining radios for the Sheriff's Department, Fire Department, Public Works, and so forth, and all the communications infrastructure that they have for the court system and everything else. And I a very, very good career. And I was struggling with alcohol, and I had a couple more mishaps with alcohol. And the final time that I went to jail in a blackout was November the 2nd of 1988. November the 2nd of 1988, I was teaching an evening class in electronics at San Bernardino Valley College. And that was my second job. I had two jobs. I worked for the county full-time, and I worked part-time for the college teaching transmitters and antenna systems for electronic communications. And I was on my way home. I left to go home, and I got a bottle of vodka because I knew when I got home the liquor stores would be closed. It was an evening class that got out at 10 o'clock in the evening, and I left for San Bernardino to drive home to Palmdale, where I lived at the time, with the wife and family and all. And my full intention was, I'm going to only have a drink when I get home. I'm only going to have a sip off that bottle that alcohol is for when I get home. I do not want to have problems. I know that if I start drinking, I don't know what's going to happen. I made it about halfway, and I decided to have just a little sip, just a little pull off the bottle to make sure, like the old Sinatra song, a little bit to get you through tonight. And the next thing I remember is I came out of a blackout in the back seat of an L.A. County Sheriff car. And I had no idea what I was under arrest for. I had no idea what had happened. I could have been under arrest for vehicular manslaughter, for drunken public, or for drunk driving. I had no idea. I had to read my booking slip to see what I was charged with. And that's where my alcoholism went. And I was suffering from my drinking had a couple bouts of gastrointestinal bleeding, which kills a lot of alcoholics, and that's where basically your esophagus starts uncontrollable bleeding, and you start vomiting up blood, and you bleed out without anyone having to stick you. That's the type of alcoholic that I was. I couldn't make it. Another thing that happened shortly before that, and I love motorcycles, riding on street, riding in dirt, doing other things. I raced dirt bikes myself from the time I was 16 years old, and I I left with a friend sometime about 6 months before that. We're going to go to Las Vegas on our road bikes. And we left Palmdale. Palmdale to Barstow is about 100 miles. And I pulled into Barstow, and I was so drunk that I fell over at a traffic signal because I forgot to put my foot down. It was a Honda Goldwing. It had a glove compartment where I could keep a bottle of vodka in the glove compartment. And I just, you know, driving down the road, I have a little sip and a little sip. And when I start drinking, I can't stop. I have no idea where I'm going with it. You know, and it's not that things have to be bad, not that things are good. It's like any time is a good time to drink for an alcoholic like me. You know, and I couldn't make it to Las Vegas, a total of about 250, 300 miles. I made it to Barstow about 100 miles, and I was so drunk that I couldn't ride the bike anymore. That's the type of alcoholic that I was. I couldn't make it from Palmdale to San Bernardino without having something to drink along the way. You know, and I, as a result of the last drunk driving, part of the bargain that I made with the DA was, and I always trying to get the angles, always trying to, you know, the easier, softer way, get someone else to pay for it, do this, do that. I figured, hey, they want me to go to this alcohol program, but what I'll do is I'll make a deal with the DA where if I go to one of these inpatient programs that they're advertising back in the 80s, maybe they'll trade that for going to the state mandated one. And the DA and my lawyer worked out the details, and I had a period of time before I could go to that. So that was a deal that I made with them. But I was done. I didn't want to drink anymore, and I knew it, and I knew that I couldn't drink. And life was coming down around me, and one of the ways that I've heard it explained, and I think it just really suits me fine, it's like you're driving this old station wagon and you're throwing all the garbage in the back behind you. And when you get to Alcoholics Anonymous, you slam on the brakes, and all this shit that you've thrown in the back starts hitting off the windshield. It just all comes forward. And that's what happened when I got sober, is all the shit started coming forward and everything came. And I did my best to work the steps the way that it talks about in the big book and the way that we're supposed to. And, you know, there's a lot that I didn't understand, and there's a lot that my sponsor and I didn't understand together. You know, I picked a sponsor, my very first sponsor, based on the fact that he rode dirt bikes, I rode dirt bikes, we had a good time, and we went out and we did all kinds of fun shit together. And we had a ball. I went in my first year of sobriety, I went to Idaho, and I raced Grand Prix up in Idaho, and I raced dirt bikes all over the western United States, just having a good time. And in the meantime, my family fell apart. My wife divorced me. I had 5 kids and a house and all that stuff. And by 2 years of sobriety and not properly working the steps and doing what I should do, at 2 years of sobriety, I was living in a borrowed trailer on a vacant lot in the middle of the Mojave Desert with no electricity, no running water, no telephone. I did have a roof over my head, you know, and basically just a generator to run a little bit of power every once in a while. That was my bottom in sobriety and trying to do that. And the first 2 years, I had it figured out. If this Alcoholics Anonymous crap doesn't work out, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get on my street bike and I'm going to miss a corner on this mountain road that's close by to where I live. And it's about 500 feet down to the river. And when I miss that corner, it's 500 feet down to the river, I won't have anything to worry about. The insurance will take care of the kids, and I'm out of here. But I'm not going to go back to living the way I was living with alcohol. I'm not going to do that. And so the choice was either A works out, or I go over to side. And you know, that is not a third step. I'll tell you right now. In the third step, we say that we turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand Him. In the third step prayer, we ask that God give us the power to do what we're, essentially God give us the power to do what we must to be of service to Him and to our fellows. It doesn't say that things are going to work out and I'm going to have the toys and I'm going to have my way. It says that I'm going to do the best I can to do God's will for me as I understand that. And see, at 2 years of sobriety, I changed my way. I changed my way of doing it because I tried to understand what this higher power thing was. That some people call God, some call the doorknob, some call the grip shots. And what do I do? How do I understand what this thing is? And I realized that I don't have to understand God. For me, trying to understand God is sort of like an ant colony understanding humanity. You know, my higher power is so much powerful over I am. All I have to do is trust that my higher power has in store for me things that I can't even imagine. My higher power is looking out after me and has my back. My higher power is going to do the best that I can. But for me to make a decision about how far I'm going to live, when I'm going to live, and everything else is not. I just show up each day and I do the best I can, one day at a time, to do what's put in front of me. And as long as I take that stance a day at a time, then I'm living the program. If I do the very best I can today, and some days I'm horrible at it, and other days I do a fairly good job. But each day I do the best I can to show up, play ball, and do what's put in front of me today, and to be of maximum service to the people about me. So that's all there is to it. And whether it's at work, whether it's in the program, whether it's in my daily life or walking down the street. If I see some place where I can be of service, where I can be an example, where I can help someone, then God will give me the tools, God will give me the power to do what God would have me do today. You know, and I'll do that. So that's what I changed my attitude, and I did that. There's, you know, this borrowed trailer was sort of not a very good place to live, and there was it wasn't a very good environment. It was way out in the country all by itself, and I managed to hang on to that job with the county, and I was still working for the county. In fact, I was supervising all of the technicians for the northern half of LA County doing communications maintenance, and I'd driven up and down this one canyon road, and there was a place that was sitting there vacant for several years. I thought, well, maybe I'll look up the property owner and see what if I could work out some arrangement, clean it up, and lease it from them for a bargain price, because I was living there because I literally didn't, even though I had a good job, I was paying so much in alimony and child support and other bills that I had acquired that I simply could not afford to pay rent on a house at that point. And I saw this, I went to the tax records, I looked up the owner, and I contacted him, and I says, oh, well, we sold that. It was sold just a month ago. And so I thought, oh, well, I don't know what I'll do. And about 2 weeks later, I was sitting there after work, and I thought, well, maybe I ought to go by and see. Maybe the new owners will be by or something. And I, just on a hunch, I drove down this canyon to where the property was, and the new owner was there talking to a guy about cleaning the place up, and he gave him an estimate of $10,000 to bring in a bulldozer and cover up all the junk. There were a bunch of old motors and car bodies and stuff like that. And after this guy went away, I says, hey, if you let me live here, I'll clean the place up for free. I'll get rid of all that junk for you. You know, and for the next several months, I hauled scrap metal to the scrap metal yard with my old pickup truck. An old beat-up pickup truck, and I'd load it with scrap metal, and I hauled it off to the scrap yard. And instead of paying rent, I made a little bit extra money. And he paid for a dumpster, and the stuff that I couldn't scrap, I put in a dumpster a little bit at a time. And after a few months, it was better. And I was there for about a year, and there was a dip in the housing market, and damn if the guy didn't lose it. He lost the property. It was repossessed. He was an investor and had a whole bunch of properties, and it was repossessed. And they did nothing. They just sat on it. So I lived there for another year. And we're going along, and in the meantime, I fix it up, and I put a roof on it and other stuff, and that's sort of what I would put in the rent if I was there. And One day after work, I was one day at work, I went to a training class, and I met this lady in a training class. And I've been single. I've been through several very dysfunctional relationships. You know, A boy meets A girl on A campus and turns into AA crazy. I did that a couple times, and you know, I've known other people that got together in AA and have a wonderful life today. I have some friends that have been married longer than I have, and got together in AA, and they're both sober in the program. But you know, I met Linda at this training class for the county, and invited her and her daughter to come up. It was toward the end of May, and we in Leona Valley, which is right where this property was, very close to it, there's a bunch of you-pick cherry orchards. So we came up and they picked cherries, and we visited for a little bit, and we started dating, and later on and not that much longer, we ended up getting engaged. And we went to Kansas and got married because her mom was terminally ill. And we wanted to get married before her mom was able to pass away. But we actually got married and then lived separately. She was in Cerritos, like 90 miles away, and I was up in the Antelope Valley. And it was about an hour and a half, two-hour drive between the two houses. But we stayed in separate households so that Amanda could graduate college. And graduate high school, when she went off to college, then we combined the households. And that was about a year and a half later. You know, that was just the way it worked out in my life and what we did. And we, we've had a wonderful relationship ever since then. I come from a large Catholic family, and we got our previous marriages annulled, and we're married in the church together at the San Gabriel Mission. And my aunt helped restore the San Gabriel Mission after it was pretty much destroyed in the Whittier earthquake. And I have a cousin who's a Jesuit priest who married us in the San Gabriel Mission. And that was pretty special for my family. It was very special for Linda and I. It was quite a deal. And we've had just a wonderful, wonderful marriage. We get to do a lot of really neat things. You know, and it took a lot of years to get that debt paid off from the early sobriety and the problems that I had with lawyer fees and everything else back going through the divorce. It was a struggle for a lot of years. But we struggled through it and we made it. And about 12 years ago, my wife was working in Los Angeles, and I was working up in the Antelope Valley, and she had a long commute down there, and I said, well, why don't you retire early? I'd leave and retire early, and we'll get by on my salary. And so she was able to retire and hasn't had to work since. That's we're able to get by on what I made. We went on. I retired last March from Los Angeles County with 37 years of service, and that's a miracle, because I was in the process of being fired, and I was dying from alcoholism, and I would not have lived to collect any retirement, regardless of where I worked or what I did, if I would have kept drinking. My body wouldn't take it. And I just, one time in sobriety, and when I was drinking about 2 years before I got sober, I had a horrible, I mean, just like someone was beating on my head with a sledgehammer headache. And every time my heart would beat, it's like someone had hit me in the head with a sledgehammer. Just boom, boom, boom. And I went into the ER room and I checked my blood. They had to go get a special machine to check it. My blood pressure was 280 over 180. And the doctor was amazed that I hadn't already had a stroke and died. Said, that's what alcohol does to me. And see, what it was is that's what alcohol does when I try to quit drinking on my own, when I try to drink without doctor's help. It's like my body's reaction, where some people have other forms of withdrawal from alcohol. My body's form of withdrawal from alcohol is to have the blood pressure go through the ceiling. And I almost died from it that time. You know, that's just part of why I cannot drink, period, anything, ever. And that's it's terminal for me. You know, in working those steps, it talks about when we do our steps, our first three steps are basically, all they are surrender steps, and they're commitment steps. We're admitting that we're powerless over alcohol. And for years, I figured that I was powerless over alcohol, but by God, my life was manageable. And it wasn't until things were just totally falling apart, and I was losing my marriage and losing my family and everything else, that I was able to admit that. And the more I can admit that my life is falling apart, and without the help of a higher power, the better off I am. You know, and that turning my will and my life over to care of God, I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea. And today, what I firmly believe is that each day I try to be the best human being that I can. And that's what it means. It means that God will give me the tools that I need to be the best human being that I can today. And intuitively, I'll know what the right thing to do is. And the right thing is to live a life based on rigorous honesty. That's what it tells us in the big book. You know, those are the things. And that higher power that saved my life will return me to sanity. In a seven-step prayer in the big book, it talks about what we're going to do. It asks that he remove the defects of character that stand in the way of my usefulness to me and my fellows. It doesn't say, give me the things that I want. Nowhere in the big book does it say, we get the things that we want. However, along the way, some of those things that we want seem to just pop up and happen. I mentioned earlier that I love dirt bike racing. I love motorcycles, street dirt bikes, and everything else. And I, when I was drinking, for an alcoholic like me that can't make it from Palmdale to Las Vegas without getting drunk and falling off the motorcycle, you know, I've managed to drive all over the country and race dirt track. I got to race dirt track in Des Moines, Illinois, and the Sacramento Mile, and other places. I'm not the fastest guy out there, but I certainly have a good time, and I'm certainly competitive. Now, a couple years ago, I raced a lot of Southern California desert, and a couple of years ago, I was invited to race on a Baja professional team. And I raced professional dirt bikes down in Baja and have won the championship for the Baja Series, the Baja 500, the Baja 1000, the San Felipe 250. I just a month ago raced the San Felipe 250 with a team down there and won the San Felipe 250. You know, at the end of the month, I'm going back down to race the Baja 500. So these things don't happen to an alcoholic like me. And I don't have someone who buys a brand new motorcycle, puts $20,000 into modifications on it to make it a competitive bike in Mexico, and then turns it over to me to ride. That doesn't happen to alcoholics that you can't trust to go from Palmdale to Las Vegas without falling off their bike in Barstow drunk. You know, that's if I were alive at all. You know, and that's the bottom line as far as, you know, have my dreams come true beyond my wildest dreams. Things have happened that I never imagined possible. Now, do I take credit for them? Absolutely not. You know, I show up and do the footwork each day, do the best job I can of what's put in front of me, and try to make the rest go. And work with other alcoholics. You know, I talked about that in the reading at the beginning of the meeting, and when we talked about that, if all else seems to fail, working with another alcoholic. I have been very, very active in AA. I was on the roundup committee for the Antelope Valley Roundup. We have a little convention there once a year, and for 10 years I was on the committee and ended up being the chairman. I was treasurer, almost every position in the committee. I've worked all of the different positions and ended up being the chairman. In H&I, there was a rehab center that I took panels into for about 12 years and did a lot of H&I work. Currently, with the years of sobriety that I have, I'm still treasurer at two meetings. And, you know, I do that just because I need I need a commitment at that meeting. I need a reason to be at that meeting every night. My home group is the Lake Hughes Men's Stag on Wednesday night, and they're missing me tonight. And tonight, because it's the first Wednesday of the month, what's even more special is it's our world's famous hot dog night. And we have a cookout an hour before the meeting. If you're ever down in the Antelope Valley, north of Los Angeles area, you know, give me a call and come there. You guys, it's a men's stag meeting. No women are allowed, but we have a meal an hour before the meeting and socialize and get together. We cook hot dogs and hamburgers and other times a little bit of other stuff. And you know, I've been a cook at that meeting before. One of my good friends is a cook there. David is cooking tonight, and you know, that's being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that's doing it. It's being there for the newcomer and showing up. And sometimes the most spiritual thing that I can do is to show up when I say I'm going to be there. And people say, well, what's a spiritual thing? Well, a spiritual thing for an alcoholic like me, a lot of times, is just to show up when I say I'm going to show up. You know, that's part of what the program is. In fact, that's a big part of what the program is. You know, I used to make a lot of promises. Oh, yeah, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll be there. And, you know, about half the time I'd show up if you're lucky. And today I try really, really hard to only make commitments to show up when I'm going to show up and to be there when I say I'm going to be there. You know, I call my wife and I tell her when I'm going to be home. I call her and I tell her if I'm going to be late. And I tell her why I'm going to be late. And I tell her the truth why I'm going to be late. I don't do anything that I don't have to not tell the truth. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, you probably feel guilty, and it's because you are. So if you quit doing the shit that makes you feel guilty, you won't feel guilty anymore. Funny how that works out, you know. If you do stuff, if you live an honest life, if you live by an honest code, you don't have to worry about making up what's going on. And living, telling people when you make a mistake is a whole lot easier than trying to cover up and not do it. It's like, do I make mistakes? Hell yes, I make mistakes. And if I forget to show up when I'm supposed to be there, I tell the person straight out, I don't try to make something up or some bullshit. You know what? I'm sorry, I forgot. And what else can I do? If I tell the truth, if I do the best I can to do what's put in front of me each day, then I can do that. And I also can admit to you and the others that I'm human. No, we are not saints. We're not expected to be saints in this program, and we're not expected to be perfect people. We're just expected to do the best we can each day to show up, to put our best foot forward, and to give it a try. You know, and I found that doing that with my work worked out really well. When I mess up, when I make a mistake, I tell my boss I made a mistake. And through that, I got a few promotions and all, and things went good. I have a very, very comfortable life today as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a whole lot better than being dead from alcoholism. It's an honor and a pleasure to come and share with you. And I thank you so much for allowing me to come share this evening. I'm Bob Koch, and I'm an alcoholic.